I had asked the question as to what is dialectical reasoning, and I had asked you an example of this reasoning to be found in the Life Divine. And Anandmayi found out an example in the second paragraph of the Life Divine. So I had said that I shall read this second paragraph, and once more we shall do this exercise in what sense is a dialectic reasoning. So if you open the chapter number 1, paragraph number 2, these persistent ideals of the race are at once the contradiction of its normal experience and the affirmation of higher and deeper experiences which are abnormal to humanity and only to be attained in their organized entirety by a revolutionary individual effort or an evolutionary general progression. Anandmayi said that this is an example of the dialectical reasoning. And I had defined dialectical reasoning as follows. It's a process of reasoning in which one set of ideas is set against another set of ideas for comparison, so that the implications of the first set and the implications of the second set are contrasted, so as to arrive at a third set of ideas, either way of synthesis or way of completion of the entire chain of reasoning, or else for continuation of a similar chain which can go on and on and on. This is the nature of dialectical reasoning. So to repeat, it's a chain of reasoning in which one set of ideas is set against another set of ideas, so that the implications of the first set of ideas are compared with the implications of the second set of ideas, in order to arrive at a third set of ideas, which is a synthesis or a completion, or which is a further chain of similar reasoning which can go on and on and on. In other words, there is no dialectical reasoning if there is no comparison. That's the essence of the matter. In every dialectical reasoning, there is a comparison. One set of ideas to be compared with another set of ideas. You compare and contrast. And when you do this, something happens and there is a generation of a third set of ideas. Now this third set of ideas is either a synthesis or a completion of the chain of reasoning, or it may be a starting point of another chain of similar reasoning. Very often it is said dialectical movement is the presentation of a thesis, an antithesis, resulting in a synthesis where you stop, or it itself becomes a beginning of another series of thesis, antithesis and synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and on . This is the process of a dialectical reasoning. And Anandmayi rightly pointed out that this particular statement which we read out just now is a good example of dialectical reasoning. Now let us see how it is so. There must be two sets of ideas, otherwise there is no dialectical reasoning. One set of ideas set against another set of ideas. Now let us see what is the first set of ideas. Anybody can tell me the first set of ideas? One set of ideas to be compared with another set of ideas. You compare and contrast, and when you do this, something happens and there is a generation of a third set of ideas. Now this third set of ideas is either a synthesis or a completion of the chain of reasoning, or it may be a starting point of another chain of similar reasoning. Very often it is said dialectical movement is a presentation of a thesis, an antithesis, resulting in a synthesis where you stop, or it itself becomes a beginning of another series of thesis, antithesis and synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and on and on. This is the process of a dialectical reasoning. And Anandamayi rightly pointed out that this particular statement, which we read out just now, is a good example of dialectical reasoning. Now let us see how it is so. There must be two sets of ideas, otherwise there is no dialectical reasoning. One set of ideas set against another set of ideas. Now let us see what is the first set of ideas. There is first the set of ideas appropriate to normal experience. And then there is a set of ideas appropriate to higher experience. There is a contrast between the two. What is the normal experience and what is the higher experience? The implications of the normal experience and the implications of the higher experience. And the two are contradicted. As Sri Aurobindo says, these persistent ideals, now these ideals are already referred to in the first paragraph, namely God, light, freedom, immortality. These persistent ideals of the race are at once the contradiction of its normal experience and the affirmation of higher and deeper experiences. This is the contrast. Now this is actually the beginning of the dialectical reasoning. Now if you read the whole paragraph, you will find a complete chain of reasoning. You take normal experience and take abnormal experience, higher experience. The implications of normal experiences are that the material world as we see it and the way in which we see it is all that is there, that is normal experience. The higher experience gives you the ideas of God, light, freedom and immortality. Now the two are in contrast. Now the argument starts. If the normal experience is the only experience, then the ideas of God, light and freedom and immortality are contradicted and therefore they are invalid. Normal experience, if it is the only limit and nothing else is available, then these ideas, being contradictory of normal experience, they are invalid. Therefore Sri Aurobindo says, if you read, to the ordinary material intellect, in the same paragraph if you see towards the middle of the paragraph, you will find the sentence, to the ordinary material intellect. You have found that sentence? Yes? You have found it? To the ordinary material intellect, which takes its present organization of consciousness for the limit of its possibilities, the direct contradiction of the unrealized ideals with the realized fact is a final argument against their validity. So since these ideals are contradicted by our normal experience, therefore normal experience says these ideals are invalid. This is the second step of the argument. First is the contrast, then the argument. Now comes the stage of synthesis. You have now two propositions before you. Therefore Sri Aurobindo says, but if you take a more deliberate view of the world's workings, their direct opposition appears rather as part of nature's profoundest method and the seal of her completest sanction. When there is a contradiction, you now make an argument. You take a deliberate view, that is to say, I told you, the quintessential metaphysical argument. The quintessential metaphysical argument is an argument which seeks the meaning, ultimate justification. So the argument is, why should there be this contradiction at all? What is the meaning of this contradiction? So when you raise this question, what is the meaning of this contradiction? Then Sri Aurobindo says, you will find that this contradiction is only a method of nature to arrive at a greater affirmation, to arrive at a synthesis. The method of nature is to create first two sets which are contradictory of each other, and then to move forward towards a synthesis. Therefore, the very fact that there is a contradiction, it does not mean, therefore, that one is valid and another is invalid. The farthest standpoint is, ultimately, this contradiction will be bridged, will be synthesized. So you arrive at a synthesis. So this whole paragraph is a good example of a dialectical reasoning. Right? We had done it earlier. It is good to revise from time to time, because it will give a good exercise in metaphysical thinking. Now we go back to Plato. We referred yesterday to the great pronouncement of Plato. Philosophers should be kings, or kings should become philosophers. And secondly, those who are only philosophers, or those who are only kings, they should be compelled to stay aside. Only if you obtain this position, Plato says, you shall be able to behold the light of day. Now this was his conviction, Plato's conviction. Now this conviction was not merely intellectual. He made a few attempts to realize the ideal of his vision. He was dynamic enough to realize this ideal. As a result, he undertook two journeys to Sicily. He went to Syracuse in Sicily, which was ruled by Dionysius II. There was a king, Dionysius II. So he made a journey to Sicily and employed himself in the task of training Dionysius II in order to make this king a philosopher. So he applied his own philosophy in action. In the first journey, he had to undergo such humiliation. It was a failure, actually. Dionysius II, first of all, invited him. He was respected, honored, and ultimately was thrown out. Plato was thrown out. And the condition came to such a pass that he was sold in the market as a slave. You can see the conviction of the man that he was even ready to undergo such a humiliation. He need not have gone at all, but his conviction was so great that if he could make one king a philosopher, a new movement could start. So he went to Sicily. Actually, there was one advisor of Syracuse, king, who was known to Plato. So he persuaded Syracuse, the king, to invite Plato. So Plato went there with the hope that he would be able to make him a philosopher. So started the training. It was a very interesting story. One day you should read the story of his training, Dionysius II. But ultimately the king was not converted to a philosopher. He was actually humiliated, sent out, and ultimately he was sold in a market as a slave. He escaped death by being ransomed by someone. Somebody passed by who knew Plato, and he bought him, and he was ransomed. Otherwise he would have been killed. If he had not at his heart the great consideration for the future of human progress, he would have declined the second invitation of Dionysius. Afterwards, Dionysius regretted, and he felt greatly a prick of his conscience, and he said, he invited him again, and Plato would have said, no, this is one experience is enough. But his own conviction was so great that he went one second time also. Of course, he failed in his attempt. Again, second time also he failed again. But his vision of the ideal state remained up to this day an inspiration to many thinkers, visionaries, statesmen, and servants of mankind. Even today, many people still believe that this vision of Plato should be realized. This is the dynamic aspect of Plato, how he was an active reformer, not only a thinker, but a reformer. However, Plato is preeminently a philosopher. He was a mathematician and gave a high place to mathematics in his system of education. In fact, it was written on his academy, "One who does not know mathematics need not enter here." That much was the importance he assigned to mathematics. Because according to him, if you want to be a philosopher, you should first be a mathematician. And there is a great reason behind it, which you shall see when we read the next part. Why he felt that knowledge of mathematics is necessary to enter into philosophy. He was an educationist, a great literary artist, a social and political thinker, a lawgiver, a utopian, and in a sense even a theologian. But all these very subordinate and supporting aspects, none supreme or equal to his philosophical personality. Philosophy is the very soul and breath of Plato. His mind is constantly fixed on the supreme idea of the good. This is the kernel of Plato. If you ask the very heart of Plato, it is the idea of the good. What is this idea of the good? We shall see in the next paper. But this is the soul of Plato. If there is one thing which Plato contributed to the history of thought, it is his idea of the good. He is constantly engaged in reconciling and harmonizing the universal ideas. His constant task is to reflect and meditate upon the real and differentiate it from the phenomenon and the appearance. This is actually the definition of philosophy, you might say. Philosophy begins when you distinguish between appearance and reality. As long as you take the world as it is, you are not a philosopher. The moment you suspect there is something else than what is visible to us, philosophical thinking begins. So, Plato made a distinction between appearance and reality. In this process, he developed what is called the theory of ideas. And the supreme point of his theory of idea is the concept of the idea of the good. Now, what is this? How he arrived at this is the substance of the second paper. So now we come to the second paper. The theory of the good. The concept of the good is the culmination of Plato's philosophy. There is, according to Plato, a distinction between reality and appearance. The former is the universal and the permanent. The latter, particular and transient. The former is the object of true knowledge. The latter, the object of either imagination or opinion. We shall stop here now and reflect upon it. It's a very important statement. The appearance is naturally what appears, isn't it? What appears is appearance. Now, anything that appears is what is presented.